Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, September 2nd, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, money and markets, and a quick, maybe not so quick question and ask Catherine, and then an interview with Richard Nolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State. And then for our Let's Go to the Movie, I asked you to watch a marvelous presentation by Richard that he did last September, describing, giving an overview to his book and the his topic of the UFO phenomenon, how it relates to the geopolitics and the economics we're all grappling with. Our theme this evening is Yes, We Can. It's from a song by the Pointer Sisters I love. And I was reminded of it last night. I drove several hundred miles through wilderness area in Montana, where I am. Sitting in the most beautiful place you can imagine, overlooking the Swan Valley and the mountain range. But as I drove last night in the dark through the wilderness areas, I had near misses with two mountain lions and over 30 deer. I finally stopped counting. And it seemed an apt metaphor for our conversation this evening, because it reminded me of the challenges of vastly different species with vastly different technology trying to coexist on one beautiful planet. The mountain lions and I managed to figure it all out, but I was really in awe of their beauty and ability to jump when a car comes flying around the turn at 70 miles an hour in the middle of the night. I hope I see mountain lions for many years to come. In money and markets, a new poll from Rasmussen, the political class and the rest of America continue to diverge. I had reported in August that 67% of the political class thinks the country is going in the right direction. 16% of mainstream thinks it is. In September, we now have 86% of the political class thinking it's going in the right direction, 19% of mainstream thinking it is. And so we're seeing just a greater divergence, and I continue to think that this is going to make this election a very interesting time as the political class to come to the town hall meetings and speak to their constituents. In the category "In the Time Waits for No Man," the U.S. Post Office is now quoting its international mailing prices in both dollars and special drawing rights. The special drawing rights of the International Monetary Fund unit of account, it's a basket of currencies. It's reported, it's denominated in U.S. dollars, but it's a basket of currencies with a value coming from a combination of the dollar, the Japanese yen, the British pound, and euros. And I find it amazingly interesting that the Post Office is doing that. And I've said for years, if you want to watch the move to one world currency, watch the SDRs and don't ignore the rumors about things like the OMERAs. There's real concern about the economy, and I think some of it is overblown because we're in summer, and summer, we're combining the typical slowdown of summer with what's going on in the recession. Now, nothing's going to change the long-term trends of squeezing out the middle class in America, but expect in the fall the global consumer to start to pick up a little bit more flack. Some of the rhetoric is coming from, it's both real, and some of it's coming from sort of people with different hands in the till on economic warfare. There's another explosion in the Gulf today. As the oil prices drop once again, we're seeing what are probably, I think, covert actions to keep the price up. If you haven't listened to the Jim Norman interview on the oil card that we did on the Solari Report and then his description of what happened in the Gulf oil spill, I strongly recommend it. Part of the concern about the economy is the mechanics of rolling over the U.S. Treasury debt that just continues to grow. We even have the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff saying that the biggest threat to national security is the national debt. And it's not surprising, because the interest on the debt is now the equivalent to 1 year of the overt military budget. Tonight, Richard Dolan and I are going to be talking about the covert side, which is even more, but just what we have on balance sheet, the interest is now equivalent, and so it means the military and the bankers are sort of competing for the same size piece. And of course, the other big nut, and we've talked about this as we reviewed the debt clock on the Solari Report, is the social benefits and retirement benefits, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the other payments that government pays out. So it's not surprising that we see, and this is up on the blog, the Department of Labor has now announced that it's holding hearings with the U.S. Treasury on September 14th and 15th on, quote, options on retirement plans. This is not good news for a couple of reasons. One is their description of options on retirement plans focuses consistently on lifetime income as opposed to assets. That's not a good sign because you're literally seeing the language change from the assets being assets that belong to people to people needing lifetime income. And, of course, we know one of the proposals on the table has been essentially converting withdrawals not into an asset that you take out, but one that converts into an annuity that you get. And, of course, that means that asset continues to finance the U.S. deficit. Now, the problem that the government has and the military is how do you force nations around the world to buy U.S. treasuries to finance Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, and other U.S. benefits for U.S. citizens when you're not forcing the recipients themselves to finance it, and they have a couple $1 trillion of assets sitting in 401ks and IRAs. So it's harder and harder to explain that away as you go around the world because you're requiring everybody else to finance it. The other reason I think this is a concern is the timing. I've mentioned before, oftentimes you'll see the powers that be literally go off to the Bohemian Grove at the end of July, beginning of August, make a series of decisions, and those decisions roll out, the work on them in the August, and then sort of roll out in September and October as the new budgets are being created. And so to see this pop up in September is a little bit unnerving to me. So I'm going to be reporting on this on the Solari. We have a Solari report the day after the second day of the hearings, and so we'll be reporting on that in September. Roundup of markets, stock markets. We continue to see the rebalancing of the global stock markets really track the rebalancing of the consumer economy away from the U.S. to the global consumer. There's a piece up on the blog posting describing that sort of shift in the price-earnings ratio and how the emerging market stocks are priced compared to the advanced countries. This is a very long-term trend. It's going to be going on for a long time. We're just in the early phases of it, but it's worth watching that. The U.S. stock market is still doing tiny sort of pumps and dumps above the 10,000 Dow level, which seems to be the level that the central banks are supporting. It really fits in with a pattern we talked about in the beginning of the year in the wrap-up, what I call the grinding of the gears. It's all part of slow burn as the corporate infrastructure sort of adapts to the lower cash flows now that the debt bubble is slowing down. We have continued reports today, again, up on the blog of retail money leaving the market. It doesn't surprise me. There's more and more concern about the fragility of the economy and the volatility. One of the great examples of high strangeness, you get these unbelievable reports of people scared about what's going in the market was, and I didn't put this up on the blog, was Tony Robbins, the motivational speaker, putting out a two-part YouTube video alert. There are more violations of the investment advisory laws than you can shake a stick at. He's essentially telling people to get out of the market, and he's a little bit all over the place. I'm still in my big chicken strategy, which is very defensive with respect to the stock market, but you watch this video and you wonder what in the world inspired this. But we're seeing more and more reports of that, of people who are very, very skittish. In the category of poor people are smarter than you think, there's another post I wanted to point out on the blog. Debt seizures happening in Minnesota through People's Bank without judicial review, including in cases where the people really don't have the legal basis of asserting a debt. It's quite chilling, and it's another argument. There's a surprising number of poor people, for example, in the neighborhood where I live in Tennessee, of people who don't have bank accounts and pay their bills with cash and money orders. I'm always astonished at how they seem to manage it all. But it's because they understand the value of keeping your financial data private and the risk of letting strangers control your cash. So it underscores my argument again, you really want to bank with honest people who you know and who know you. Because when these situations come up, you want to have a relationship. The other thing is, anything we can all do to get and stay out of debt is important, because the risks of debt are becoming greater and greater in this kind of environment. Fixed income markets have been the beneficiary of a high dollar, which continues, and a fixed income bubble. It's hard to believe yields could go any lower, but my prediction is they could, because the central banks will absolutely do everything they can to protect the debt. Or at least for the foreseeable future. The housing market, in the sign of the times, my mortgage has now been transferred. I refinanced my house, in 2008, I believe it was. My mortgage is now transferred for the third time. I got a letter offering a workout. My mortgage is in good standing, and I haven't asked for a workout, but nonetheless, I got a letter offering a workout. I tell you what it's about, except I cannot get through. I've gotten a busy signal because I've tried about 12 times. I'm pretty curious. That's a perfect example of what's going on in that market. Precious metals, we're watching now that the summer is over, the next leg up in gold and silver prices. Again, my high for the year is $1,350 on gold. Franklin was $1,375. More on that next week on the precious metals market report. But again, I think both of our expectation is this fall and winter we're going to see the sort of next move up. My hero this week is a new person I just discovered. She did an interview that I put up on the blog. It's Robin O'Brien, author of The Unhealthy Truth, How Our Food is Making Us Sick and What We Can Do About It. She's a Colorado mom, got a Wall Street background, who explains on the video the dangers of the current food system, and really just a remarkable woman. And I really would check out that blog. Her understanding of how busy most people are and how it can be absolutely overwhelming to understand and learn what's going on with the food supply and to change, her understanding of what that entails is really remarkable. And she's very, she comes at it from an interesting point of view. So it's very remarkable, and a very remarkable person. I've ordered the book. And if I like it, I may in fact try and get her on the Salary Report. For Ask Catherine this week, we have great precious metals questions, which I'm going to defer to next week. I like to batch them all during the precious metals market report. The question that I did get that I'm going to take a long time answering, and is a great way to introduce Richard, is the question was, why did you turn lunch down with an alien? Now, what many of you probably don't know is the story of my being asked to lunch with aliens, so I'll tell it. In 1998, I was asked by the head of a think tank that did a lot of work for the Navy to participate in a high-level strategic plan for the Undersecretary of the Navy regarding, sort of the future of the Navy and the changes in their operating environment. And as a sort of a exploration of whether I was going to be involved or not, I went to a series of meetings with high-level military and retired military at a number of think tank meetings. And the Undersecretary of the Navy and his wife came over to my house for brunch. And finally, after a series of these meetings, I said to the head of the think tank, I said, look, what's the gist of this? What's our goal? You know, what are we trying? What is the Navy trying to accomplish? What are we trying to accomplish for the Navy? How do I make sure I add value? And he said to me, well, you know, the Navy wants to understand what it means to their operating environment to function in a world where the average person understands that aliens exist and live among us. And I said, well, you know what? I don't know that. I don't know that aliens exist and live among us. And he looked at me and he said, well, would you like to have lunch with some aliens? And it was about the only time in my life that I immediately saw flashing before me in my imagination a picture of the National Enquirer sitting at the checkout stand, and a big headline at the top saying, Fitz thinks she's launching with aliens. And I was in the middle of managing the litigation of Hamilton Securities with the Department of Justice, and I was the recipient of some amazing smear articles, just, you know, completely. It's one of those times when you realize that the media often prints blatant lies when they have permission of the powers that be to do it. And I said to this person, you know, I'm just managing too much risk right now to be seen lunching with aliens. And it was one of those minutes I couldn't believe these words were coming out of my mouth. But the reality was it wasn't clear to me that it was a sincere offer. And I just, there's something about the whole thing that didn't sit right with me. And my first obligation was to do an excellent job on the litigation, and I just felt it was not, you know, appropriate to pursue it anymore. And the project kind of fizzled out. And so we never went forward with my participating in any strategic plan for the Navy. Now, what happened was the think tank then invited me to join their board of directors. And what I said to them was, look, I'm happy to read books on this topic. And that began an effort. I'm a speed reader where I've read literally hundreds and hundreds of books and articles on the question of what are UFOs, what is the truth of the many reports of abductions, of crop circles, of all sorts of strange phenomena. And for many years I've grappled with how to communicate this, how to present it. And one of the challenges is that I have no personal first-hand knowledge, and it's not a subject that really lends itself to the tools that I use, which is the economics. You know, because if you're talking about the economics of Earth, it doesn't lend itself to understanding things that might not be of the Earth or at least this dimension or this time period. And so I've looked constantly for books. Now, in the meantime, I have spent a lot of time researching the black budget phenomena, which I consider to be very, very important to the economics that I grapple with, whether it's for clients or subscribers, and the things that deeply touch our day-to-day life and the quality of our day-to-day life and our risks. And I've become convinced that there is that we're literally watching what Richard Dolan calls a breakaway civilization. In other words, we have seen an infrastructure of private corporations and private interests take hold of very advanced technology, have the blessing of very significant amounts of governmental and government protected and organized money, build a phenomenal infrastructure of secret projects and technology that has a voracious appetite for our money and touches us with everything from the drug dealing that impacts our neighborhood to the financial fraud that can impact our assets and the quality of our assets, including, as we saw in the stock market and the financial markets in 2008. As you saw from the blog post, Richard describes it as a breakaway civilization. I love that description. And the reality is, if you look at what I do day to day to day, I spend most of my time trying to track that breakaway civilization and understand how I can help my clients protect and my subscribers protect their time, their money, their health from that breakaway civilization and its voracious appetite for resources, or the government's challenge of trying to manage, managing the government in a world where you literally have two civilizations trying to go side by side, and really not converging but diverging in very significant and radical ways. So it's something that is accelerating change. It's creating risks for all of us. And despite all the hundreds of books I've read, I've never found one until, I guess it was at the beginning, earlier on this year, I got a copy of Richard's book in the mail. I think he sent it to me, and someone sent it to me. And it was the first time I had found something that that created a framework that integrated all the different issues, the many, many reports of UFO sightings and other phenomena related to this, as well as a discussion of the geopolitical and economic impacts of not only infrastructure building up to deal with this phenomenon and the technology that spins off of it, but the consequences to our civilization of that infrastructure going private and going secret, and really privatizing, as Richard says, privatizing the secrecy of it. Anyway, so with that in mind, I thought, okay, this is finally we have something that we can use to discuss this in a very professional framework that will help me bring it down to an issue of how does it impact us and what can we do about it. So with that in mind, it's my great pleasure to introduce you, Richard Nolan. Are you with us?
I am, Catherine. Thank you for having me on your show. It's a pleasure.
Well, welcome to the Solari Report.
It's a pleasure.
So we hear you know, in the media these days about the clash of civilizations, and you know, one description is it's the Muslims versus the Christians. And in fact, that's not the real clash of civilizations going on planet Earth. So maybe if you could describe what you think is the clash of civilizations that are going on.
Gladly. I agree with you. I think that's not the true clash. Of course, it's always a matter of perspective. If you're looking at like a micro level, you could see lots of differences between Western and, say, Islamic culture. Sure, why not? But let's step back a little bit. It must be difficult for, people, anyone who's studied mainstream political machinations all these years to even take the topic of UFOs seriously in any way. I myself did not grow up with any kind of interest in that particular topic. I was working on a doctoral dissertation in international studies in Cold War history at the University of Rochester, where I live in Rochester, New York, back in the 90s. And, they don't do flying saucers in the curriculum, I can assure you. That's just not what comes up. I became interested, sort of stumbled onto the topic, and realized that at least there was some reason to believe that this was being taken seriously, that, my goodness gracious, there appeared to be confirmed government documents that discussed the matter of UFOs in a serious way. And it was at that moment, really in the mid-90s, that I thought, I don't really want to know if UFOs are real yet. I want to know, is this part of my country's history? Is this part of my world's history? Were there important people, as it appeared, who were taking this seriously at high levels, senior national security levels? And if they were, why had I never read about it in any academic context ever? How could that not be interesting, I thought. One thing led to another, and the next thing I know, I'm researching and writing about this topic. What I think we're dealing with is are a variety of civilizations. I mean, if you go through the history of humanity, we've seen that there are indeed multiple civilizations that had coexisted throughout much of our history. Go back 500 years. You have Western, you've got the Near East, you've got China, you've got, all of these in Western Hemisphere. They all coexisted. And really the story of the last 500 years of our world, you could say, is the interweaving of those separate civilizations to create a kind of global village. So we have this example in our history, and myself, looking at the UFO topic, my own research has convinced me that a couple of things have happened. A, U.S. military and other militaries have been chasing objects that are not supposed to exist. And we can certainly explore that a little bit. B,
And this is not a few reports. This is thousands and thousands of reports.
Thousands of pages of reports, and I would say several hundred really good reports that we have had confirmed to us. And my own estimation is that there is much, much more that has been withheld to us. What we've received have only been of mid-levels of classification. In other words, classified, secret, and confidential, and restricted. Those alone are fascinating and are, in fact, very disturbing at times. So we have that. And then we have a situation where it looks to me, and a lot of other researchers have spent time in this, that not just are there things out there that we're chasing around, but rather some of these things, or somehow some of us got hold of some of their technology. Now, we're going to be talking about like the Roswell retrieval, for example, which I personally think did happen. I think there have been another number of other cases. The bottom line is that if you recover technology that doesn't belong to us, presumably for 60 years, you're not just going to sit on your hands and look at it. You're going to try to study it and make sense out of it. And this is exactly what I think has happened. So that, in fact, it's become my argument that the UFO phenomenon, in fact, is one of the key initiators of the modern black budget, period. And the reason that I think that is that you go back to 1947, 48, and presume or assume that we've got this military possession of this exotic non-human technology. Clearly, they're going to have to keep this away from Congress, because there goes the secret if you tell Congress. And if you want to maintain a monopoly over the technology, you got to keep the secret. And so by its nature, I think it required an end run around formal constitutional budgetary practices. I'm not saying the UFO secret was the only creator of the black budget. Clearly, I wouldn't argue that. But I do believe it was an important contributor. And I would just continue this.
The first legal structure for the black budget was the 47 and 49 Act. Wasn't it right before the 47 Act?
Roswell happened right in the midst of the passage of the National Security Act. Roswell occurred in early July. And the National Security Act and the entire Defense Department realignment from the War Department to the Defense Department, the creation of the National Security Act, all of this was being debated and discussed that spring, May and June, and then in mid-late July it was passed. And in that environment, Roswell happened and the whole flying saucer mania. Sightings were all over the country for a while. They were reported for a while, and then they just stopped. It's interesting, and none of us, not myself and not anyone that I know, has really been able to prove that there's an absolute connection between the National Security Act and Roswell, but it looks very suggestive to me. But if I would take it one step further now, so let's assume that deeply clandestine groups have had possession of this technology. What I believe has happened is that a couple of things. One, you know, this technology might be so far beyond us for the longest time, we'd like think, how the heck do we figure it out? But you know what? There are a lot of brilliant people in private industry do contract work for the government, a lot of smart scientists and engineers. And how difficult is it to imagine that after 5 or 10 years, a group of scientists have some eureka moment where they think, you know, we can't duplicate all the electromagnetic properties of this thing, but we can do some other cool things like, oh, I don't know, high tensile fibers or lasers or fiber optics or who knows what. So on that level, you've got great ground floor investment opportunities. So there goes your incentive, if you ever had one, for giving up the secret, because this is a goose that lays golden eggs. But the other thing is this. Let's hypothesize that not only does this technology make you lots of money in the form of new defense industries and technologies, but let's say that there are breakthroughs that are so dramatic, so important, so out there that you think, maybe we don't want to share this one. Let's say breakthroughs like, field propulsion, anti-gravity, in other words, super longevity. I'm not saying that these have definitely happened. I do believe that there is evidence, in my view, to show that we have been building our own little fleet of flying saucers.
Right.
Now, if they operate the same way as the real ones, I don't know. But the point is this, that this infrastructure now, if they've made any breakthroughs that they don't share with the rest of us, now it seems to me that they're on a fast track to almost run away from the rest of us. Because as science works, one breakthrough can often lead to another and lead to another and so on. I think it's entirely possible that they've jumped so far ahead of the rest of us that they may even wonder how on earth, so to speak, are they going to bring the rest of us up to speed, if ever.
One of the reasons I so resonated with the expression breakaway civilization is for years I litigated with a group of people who literally were above the law. In other words,
Exactly. So
the laws of the Constitution and the laws of civil procedure and the laws of criminal procedure, and you know, they just didn't have to obey all.
Well, you wrote
whatever they wanted.
You wrote a great article. I think it's a classic, if I may just say this to you, which is called "The Myth of the Rule of Law." It's one of my favorite articles that you've written.
Well, it was so funny to watch because you were literally watching two parallel civilizations, two parallel legal structures, two parallel cultures trying to kind of, you know, deal with each other and not hiccup each other. And it was amazing because literally, and then there was this whole covert world of people who, you know, they lived in a parallel universe. And they thought our universe was ridiculous. Now, of course, I'm talking about people who are all human. And so, whatever the civilizations are represented by the UFOs, you know, we now have this second civilization of the people who, you know, have inherited whatever technology they've inherited and have functioned in a secret, private way and have literally legally and financially become very separate from us.
I agree with that. And there are times when I just think, you know, this is so criminal, so wrong. And I certainly would never defend what they do. On the other hand, it's not difficult, at least in some of my moments, to understand why they would have done what they did. I can imagine, you know, faced with this bizarre, scary reality, potentially very scary, of others, whoever they happen to be, with technology that seems vastly beyond what we have, trying to understand who they are, what do they want, what's going on. It isn't difficult for me to imagine that they would feel the need to go into high gear to try to meet this challenge, and at the same time, maybe, at least initially, think, we can't tell the world about this. This is way too much. This is going to cause too much craziness. And so we're going to keep it secret for a while. And I think secrets can just have their own momentum, their own profitability, and the next thing you know, you've created this massive black infrastructure that has, as it were, broken away to a large extent from our current civilization.
One of the things I love in your book is your description of the history of different citizen and volunteer efforts to try and understand what was happening.
Yeah, it's a fascinating part of our own history, I think, yeah.
Yeah, and the people involved.
Well, it's just one of these things that when I wrote this, both of the volumes of history, which are called UFOs and the National Security State, I'm working on a third volume that'll be out in a couple of years. It's really a series that stands, in a sense, on three major legs. Leg one would be an almost encyclopedic understanding of the major events and sightings themselves. So, in that sense, you could use my book as a resource and think, what does Dolan have to say about the Travis Walton abduction case of 1975? And you could look it up and find everything you need. Another leg would be trying to understand the politics. That is, understanding, you know, is there a government attitude? Is there a military intelligence community attitude toward this and so forth? And also trying to understand who's in charge, which is not always easy to do. And then the third leg is what you've just referred to, which would be, in a sense, I almost look at it as a history of our own human consciousness. That is, our attempts, basic though they may have been, to understand and grapple with this phenomenon, and much of that at a citizen level. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a fascinating story, and I really wanted to tell that one, too. And you're absolutely right. There's been major developments, really from the 50s onward, right up to our own time, by citizens, many of them, you know, not tinfoil hat wearers, by the way. These are very, very sharp, engaged, politically astute people, many of them, who have sought to bring the UFO topic out into the mainstream and sort of to break the secrecy, as it were. This is a long story, and one thing that I definitely noticed in the second volume of history, which you've been referring to, that covers years 1973 to 91, is that, you know, Watergate and the aftermath of Watergate actually were very important in dealing with UFO secrecy, because it was after Watergate that we had a strengthened Freedom of Information Act. and it was the Freedom of Information Act, which went through a couple of liberalized laws in the 70s that allowed for thousands of pages of these formally classified documents to be released. And it was that
moment. Remarkable how much it's contributed.
Absolutely crucial. And the FOIA law, the Freedom of Information Act, was, it's gone through its ups and downs over the years. It really had its heyday during the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter genuinely promoted liberalized interpretation of the Freedom of Information Act and told federal agencies, he was explicit about this, that you must be responsive to citizen requests for information that, and there's the caveat, that does not negatively affect national security. So that, but nonetheless, you know, it was the late 70s. It was after Watergate. It was after Vietnam. There was a certain mood in this country that I don't think in my lifetime I've ever seen before or since. And so there was. Actually, people shook that tree, and a lot of stuff came out. In 1982, in the early Reagan years, there was an executive order issued that took a lot of the wind out of the sails of Freedom of Information. It exempted NORAD, for example, totally exempted NORAD, and also did not require these agencies to respond quickly or cheaply. So suddenly UFO researchers in the mid-80s are putting out FOIA requests, and they're being told, well, that's going to cost you $30,000. When you don't have a lot of money to make these requests, well, there it goes.
Playing the FOIA game can be very productive, but it takes enormous persistence. And the more resources you have, the easier it gets.
Yeah, and one of the things that I noticed in looking at the history of these UFO groups, the citizen groups in the 70s especially, today as well, there's no money. There's
right.
No money. You're talking about dedicated people who are usually have a full-time job doing something else, and they're just obsessed
about it. They just hurtle away at it.
They're into it, yeah. And so resources are limited. There's no institutional support. There's no financial corporate backing or anything like that.
Now, I think it's so important, and this comes that you do a very good job of bringing this down in the book, is the amount of disinformation and sort of sabotage these kinds of groups have had to manage and deal with.
That's
so
exactly.
You have the... You know, you have the guys who are keeping the secrets also proactively trying to mess with the people who are trying to bring transparency.
Absolutely. What I really believe happened, this is my current thesis on the situation, is that by around 1980, there were two significant threats to the secrecy on the UFO topic. One, I've mentioned the Freedom of Information Act, and all of these documents are suddenly coming out into the public. The other threat were what we would call the land of leaks. A lot of individuals, military, retired, were coming out of the woodwork, so to speak, talking quietly to researchers about things like, well, Roswell and crash retrievals, and a widow would say that my husband had told me that when he worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, he on one occasion had to guard alien bodies in a room. You know, these types of stories started to come out and were being collected and organized. And that led to the biggest of those stories, which was Roswell. And so by 1980, if we were on the side of managing the secret, for example, we would might be concerned. Would one of these crash retrieval stories hit pay dirt? Would someone hit a home run with that one? Or would the right document be released that would really cause us a problem? And so what definitely happened, and I think the reason is to disable this movement, what happened is that the CIA and Air Force Intelligence, I think CIA working through Air Force Intelligence, was responsible for releasing documents of disputed authenticity. I say disputed authenticity, not fraudulent necessarily. These are documents that don't have proper provenance. They're in the field, they're called the MJ-12 documents. They're very interesting. What they did, they were released in quietly, anonymously in 1984 to some researchers. And if you read them straight up, you think, wow, this is Harry Truman's talking about, we got to start an organization to monitor the ET situation. It's talking about crash retrievals.
I find the COINTELPRO documents or the disinformation documents are always more entertaining.
Well, they're fascinating. They certainly make for better reading. Although, I would hasten to add, there are some amazingly fascinating, legitimate UFO reports. But yes, you're right. And so the question is, well, the result of the release of the MJ-12 documents, and there were a number of other shenanigans going on. There's just so much to get into here, but there was a lot going on in which it was clear that Air Force intelligence had infiltrated and was monitoring a lot of UFO groups and kind of stirring up the pot. What happened was that forever after, for the last 25 years now, UFO researchers still cannot agree. They still argue about these documents. There's still factions that agree. And the other upshot of it is that a lot of people have lost faith in the ability to get the right document. They almost don't even care, you know, what's real, what's not real. And so that program, that disinformation program, I think, was very effective. And by the way, that doesn't mean that the MJ-12 documents are completely fake. I've always felt that the best disinformation can't be complete fakery. I mean, that would be found
right,
out.
It has to resonate. It has to have a
absolutely
some gist of.
And I think my feeling is, if I were running disinfo on this, I would take something that I know to be true, but I would release that information in such a way that it's sort of disabled in the public realm and that everyone ever after says, oh, yeah, right, sure, I heard about that on the X-Files or I read about that in the MJ-12 documents. You know, and I think that's a great way to disable the truth.
Let's just walk through some of the theories. We're not going to get into the whole phenomena because it's a very big topic, but you know, if it's both UFOs and abductions, let's just walk through some of the theories as to various people's explanation of what this may represent.
Like who these other beings are?
Yeah, and where do they come from?
Yeah, well, I kick this one around quite a lot. In fact, I've been writing about that for a forthcoming book, which I've co-authored with a great guy. We call it AD, After Disclosure, and I think of it as a what-if book, what if UFO secrecy actually were to end. One of the things that we try to do is to understand, well, if UFO secrecy ends, it's going to matter who these other beings are. So who could they be? And when you go through the literature and you try to look through it logically, there are a couple of possibilities. Certainly, I think any Vegas odds maker would probably put the extraterrestrial hypothesis right out there as at least one of the leading possibilities. My own feeling is that this is entirely possible. We ourselves are not that far away in my view of being able to actually go to other star systems. Maybe not us biologically. But if you look in the future of artificial intelligence, machine intelligence, I don't really think it's all that outrageous to say, will we 50 years from now have sentient machines that can make a journey, 10 light years away? And I think we might be able to do it. So I think the ETH, as it's called, is a real possibility. But there's some pretty interesting ones. I've wondered about, sometimes I call it the Atlantis hypothesis. Is there a lost early human civilization? And talking about a breakaway civilization, what if, and I'm not saying this is actually true, but there are people who believe it, what if during the antediluvian period, you know, before the great flood, before the melting of the ice, the last ice age, if there was an advanced civilization, if they did obtain some type of scientific breakthroughs and secrets, and then maintain themselves over the millennia as a kind of secret society that's quietly ruled the world.
Right.
Is it possible? Well, 10 years ago I would have said, come on, give me a break. Now, I'll listen to it. And one of the things that makes me wonder about this is the large number of reports of totally human-looking so-called aliens. You get this a lot. A lot. So does that mean that the extraterrestrials have simply hybrided themselves and made themselves look like us? Are they using humans to work for them, or are they a separate group of humanity? I don't know. But I think the Atlantean hypothesis, sure, why not? Is time travel a possibility? I wonder about this. If only for one reason. whatever these objects are, it appears to me that they have the possibility of being able to manipulate our space-time reality. In other words, they can manipulate time, possibly, in ways that we don't understand. They seem, for example, to wink in and wink out of our reality, at least according to certain witness reports. There's a lot of talk about them being able to manipulate gravitational field, and if you can manipulate gravity, you might be able to manipulate time. And so is it time travel? Well, the rumor mill certainly doesn't lack for that. You know, us from the future coming back to monitor us at this particular point in our history. Maybe. Then you get into the ideas of dimensions. I've personally spoken with sources that I believe are true deep inside sources who have said point blank to me that dimensions matter, that we're not just talking about beings from another planet, although we might be, but that somehow there are multiple dimensions and that they have the ability to go in and out. There are some very bizarre cases that I think are legitimately investigated that point to this. There's the famous Skinwalker Ranch case out in Utah that was written about by my friend journalist George Knapp and scientist Colm Kelleher, talking about very weird, strange, bizarre things going on at this one particular place in Utah, that, like interdimensional portholes and strange creatures and everything. So, you know, what I try to do is I look at these possibilities, and I will never pretend that I know the answer to this until I meet face-to-face with one to my own satisfaction. But I think that they're possible. To me, the important thing to keep in mind is to remind ourselves, whatever the answer to UFOs are, and could it, the other possibility, of course, is are they disinformation from the clandestine world itself, from the get-go? Is that a possibility? We can explore that, but the point that I would emphasize here is simply, whatever that answer is, it is important to us. It matters. Matters for a lot of reasons. It matters if for no other reason than that, you know, we have a choice to sleepwalk our way through our lives or actually to learn some truth before we die. Maybe not everyone cares, but I care, and I think I suspect a lot of people listening care.
The things that comes out in the book, you had some stories, and there were some I wanted to tell, is, I think part of the thing that keeps that secret a secret is when you start into this topic, you start into a reality which is very, for most people, is very weird. I told you the story when I first heard Whitley Strieber and his wife talk, and one of the people in the audience asked him, do any of the movies about Alien really capture the feeling of what it's like to be in the presence and deal with aliens? And he said, no, they don't, because he said there's no words I know of in the English language to describe to you how weird it feels.
If I recall, he actually also implied that it's like you almost feel naked. They can peer almost right into your soul, as he felt. I think that's one way he described it.
Right. And, the other thing that was very interesting about his description was when he published Communion, and you described this in the book about the, it was both Whitley and one other in the late 80s.
Bud Hopkins, perhaps.
Yeah, it was Hopkins.
Yeah.
What a profound impact that had on the sort of thinking about this whole
Absolutely,
topic.
Yeah. Yeah.
He put a P.O. box in the slipcover so that people could write to him. It was his wife's idea. And they were stunned at the outpouring. That's another aspect of this. The people who have had an experience of some kind, whether it's a sighting or abduction, and then find, that if you think that experience was weird, wait till you see how weird it is to try and tell your government and your family and friends.
Exactly. I've spoken to hundreds of people myself, one-on-one, and not always in the context of doing my UFO research. I have a life outside of that, and I bump into people all the time. They find out that I study this, and then suddenly here come the stories. I've spoken to hundreds of people. and almost none of them made a report of what they saw or of what happened to them. And so it's a disturbing thing about our society, when you think about it, that someone who experiences the most sometimes traumatic event of their life, or at least the most amazing event of their life, is not, they don't feel that they're able to talk about it almost with anybody, sometimes not even their spouse, because they don't have the stomach for the ridicule. Most people aren't heroes, you know, they don't want to fight the battle. They don't want to have to deal with all of that. And so they just quietly go through their life. And then the next thing you know, it's like pushed back into the recesses of their life. And they meet someone who's interested in it, and it rehashes it all. But it doesn't say good things about our society, in my view.
Well, ridicule is the most important tactic to protecting the secret. And it's been very effective. I mean, not just in this area, but in, you know, certainly in the financial fraud area, you know, ridicule is a very, very powerful tactic. And making something socially acceptable, for example, I'm in the financial area, and if you're a serious financial person, you know, you're not supposed to broach this topic. It's supposed to be not socially acceptable. Now, what I know is the bridge, and this is where we're going to go next, is the black budget. Because the reality is, a group of soccer moms who try to get together and back the drugs out of their neighborhood find, you know, black helicopters and men in black and James Bond coming down on their head because the drugs in their neighborhood is financing the black budget, or the mortgage fraud in their neighborhood is financing the black budget. And now what's happening is, you know, whether it's the value of their real estate or the value of their IRA portfolio, or just the safety of their children or themselves. You know, we're now talking about a very significant drain on their economic condition and physical safety because of this stuff. And so
exactly.
The danger to most people is not, you know, I'm not worried that my subscribers are going to get abducted. I'm worried that their assets are going to get abducted by the, you know, by the black budget in its many forms.
I have often tried to figure out, to understand, how is it that this program, by this program I mean like the program to replicate and the UFO technology and just to, in general, deal with these other beings, how is it funded? Where does the money come from? And obviously, well, it's black budget, but what does that mean? Where is that money coming from? And we've talked about narcotics trafficking. It does seem to me that this is, if you need a source of money that's not going to be accountable or accounted, then drugs are perfect because everyone, it's one of the biggest industries in the world. It's, you know, up there with the top ones. It generates huge amounts of revenue, and it's all unofficial. Everyone wants this money, whether you're some street corner pusher or some cop on the take or the Chase Bank of New York. Everyone wants it. Or the CIA or the KGB or the, you know, other intelligence agencies. They all want this money. And so if you're the breakaway group, the breakaway civilization, you want that money too, it seems to me. You need to generate. I spoke to a scientist who is had background with a number of the alphabet soup agencies, a very extremely brilliant man. Nice guy. Told me he knows about this program to some extent and said to me it's very expensive. And he pointed out an interesting fact or factoid that the security on maintaining this was 7 to 8 times more expensive than the actual scientific R&D.
Right, which makes it fantastically expensive.
Exactly. So you've got to have all this money, and can you really get it straight from you can't just put it in the congressional budget. So you've got to have all of these neat little ways, like drug trafficking, I would think, to raise that money. And this is just one way that the UFO topic does affect, I think.
One of the things that's amazing is when you study financial fraud during Iran-Contra during the 80s and then, you know, the housing bubble during the 90s and the kind of bailouts we've had, and you start counting up and adding all the money, you know, the money missing from the federal government to pump it up in the stock market.
Yeah.
What you start to realize is, you know, this cannot be explained by offshore accounts and rich people having Ferraris. We're talking about the kind of money that finances, you know, secret space programs. So
right.
when I read in your book the concept of secret space programs, I say, well, you know, that fits with the kind of money that's disappearing.
You can't, many billions.
You can't explain this kind of money with a few rich people needing Ferraris.
No, and I guess I would hasten to add, if, for anyone listening to this, if this is all new to them, it's easy to say, oh, come on, that's just crazy talk. All I would say is that there's much more persuasive evidence for anomalies in Earth orbit than I think most people are aware of. There are defense satellite printouts that I personally have that deal with trackings of what are called fast walkers in Earth's atmosphere. And the fact is hundreds are on record that have been tracked. These are objects that are doing things that there are no satellites corresponding to them, and some of these things are able to maneuver. They're out there. There are also, there's quite a lot of very good video footage that has been made available. I have some of it on my website at keyholepublishing.com that is from NASA, from Russian, European Space Station missions, and so on. I'm not saying every one of these things are proof of aliens, but there's some bizarre things that are going on in Earth orbit that are captured on video, and I don't know how to explain them. Objects doing U-turns in space.
Right. I mean, if you just take all the phenomena that's been reported where there's credible documentation, and you add up the cost of it, if you just cost out as a budgetary matter what it costs to build and field all that stuff. I mean, let's say this is all this information coming from, you know, the covert side of the house on Earth.
Yeah.
If you look at the financial ramifications of what has been absolutely documented, we're talking about an enormously expensive infrastructure.
Exactly. And it's, I think you're making a very good point here in that it isn't necessary. I certainly am very open in what I think is going on here. I happen to think that there are non-human intelligences, but frankly, it almost doesn't matter. What matters is that someone has got some technology that's not supposed to exist, and that stuff is expensive. And so it matters for our global economy. Who's paying for it? Who's benefiting from it?
Right. And when you talk about a breakaway civilization, I mean, one of the things, if you look at what is happening in technology that we know about, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, we are talking about we are now in a period, and I think the term you used to describe it is, where the human race is literally reinventing itself.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're in the middle of the reinvention of everything because...
And literally is right. I mean, this is not a figure of speech.
Right.
We've moved... So you think about us. Go back 10,000 years, okay? Farmers just starting to learn the rudiments of agriculture using these primitive scythes to cut wheat out of the field. 150 years ago, if you were going in the middle of the French, some French peasant's field, he'd be using basically an implement not much different from what was used many thousands of years before. Obviously, there have been other advances, but really, even 100 plus years ago, we had a society of horses pulling carts, rough, generally speaking. And suddenly, after these thousands of years of stasis, we go kaboom. We get electricity and cars and airplanes and bombs and atomic bombs and then guided missiles and computers and nanotech and AI and iPods and iPhones.
Right, and the change is going to accelerate.
And absolutely. So where are we going to be? Time is not going to stop. AI experts, almost to the one, are convinced that at some point, probably in the lifetimes of most of us listening, it could be 10 years, could be 20, maybe 50 years, probably not that long, that your computer will be talking to you and it's going to sound human, except it'll be able to do a quadrillion number of calculations per second and pull any bit of data off the Internet. So it'll be like a really smart person that never needs to sleep. That's going to be our world, and it won't just stop there. Many people believe that we will be increasingly interfacing with these intelligences. We may have little nano chips in our own brain that enhance our own intelligence. We may have developments in
that maybe they're voluntarily
biotech.
Or not.
Beg your pardon?
That maybe they're voluntarily or not.
Right, and also it's bit speculated. I don't know, but what if the super elite of our world think, well, this will be good for us. We're going to leave the masses, and we're going to genetically modify them to be good worker bees and drones. Who knows? The point is that we are a century from now. There's a very good chance that there may not be any old-fashioned, unenhanced Homo sapiens. We may be completely interfaced with a super-advanced, hyper-advanced artificial intelligence, and who could even predict what our human civilization would look like at that point? So we are literally reinventing ourselves. And the last thing I would say on these other beings, whoever they are, is it seems to me that if they've been watching us, they must know that we are about to leap into their world. They must know this. And I think that might be another reason why they would be particularly interested in us. They might be looking at us thinking, wow, they're going to be an issue in a short while.
It seems to me that the reason that, I mean, to me, transparency is important for many, many reasons. But one is, whatever change we go through, I think it's, to me, it's better that it's a change we all go through. It's not one with one civilization, which is literally breakaway. And
absolutely,
taking this technology and in engineering for themselves a much higher learning metabolism, and the divergence just becomes greater and greater and greater. I mean, that becomes a very dangerous,
absolutely,
and untenable situation.
It seems that we're at a crossroads in our development as a species and as a civilization. And that crossroads is, what way are we going to go? We can go into a way of a global police state. As Orwell, I think I'm paraphrasing him here, you know, the image of a boot over the face of the human being forever and ever. That's one possibility, and it really can happen. But the other possibility is, if you know, can we as a people have the strength and foresight and courage to say, no, we need an inclusive future for all of humanity, and we need transparency in our government, and no more breakaway groups, no more breakaway civilizations. We all have to be on the same page. Can we do that?
Well, if we can deal with the weirdness, then we can also be the beneficiary of the opportunity. I mean, I look at the children I love, and I want them to have the opportunity, you know, if it's there, to pilot a starship and to see not just the world, but the universe.
I have always felt that all of us, every single one of us, has many, many more stores of strength and fortitude and, you know, than we think we have. Often we don't find it until we're forced to, until we're pushed into some crisis situation in our life, and then we look back and think, wow, how did I do that? So I think we do have much more strength and courage to deal with crisis than we may think. And so I do believe that whatever the truth is on this topic, and I do consider it the greatest mystery of our time, and maybe of all time, whatever that truth is, we can handle it. It may not be easy. I think there may be people who really have a rough time with it, but I think overall, and as succeeding generations, you know, appear on this world, they'll deal with it. The first step may be the hardest, and we've got to be able to do that, but I do retain an optimism about human nature and
Well, the interesting thing about the economic crisis is we don't have an economic crisis. We have a political crisis. And in other words, if you look at the wealth of our civilization, given the technology that's available, the wealth should be many, you know, literally hundreds of multiples of what it is now. And the reason it is what it is very much driven by the politics, including the secrecy, the divergence, all of these things we've been talking about.
Suppose if Adam Smith's vision actually were to be implemented.
Right.
God forbid.
And, you know, but we again, this breakaway civilization has such a need for control, and it has such a voracious appetite to finance the, you know, whatever it's doing without sharing the technological benefits.
Well, and the scary thing, when I look over the course of human history, really it's been the rule, not the exception, that elites have monopolized wealth, you know, for themselves. You go back to
right. Nobody gives up privilege easily.
No. I mean, and if you have the advantage, you're going to try to take more and more of it. And in this case, what's happened is that we've had an elite sort of develop in secrecy, in a sense. And I think they like it that way. Why would they
right.
want?
Right, and it's the elite, in fact, that's turning on the other elites.
Which do you mean specifically?
In other words, the breakaway civilization has a new elite that's kind of a meta elite, and there are lots of elites globally that are getting hurt and are no longer on the inside in this sense.
Right, absolutely. It's really like a kind of clandestine war of feudal estates against
right.
each other.
You're seeing sort of lots of squabbling break out among the elites, and it's kind of the old world guys and then the black budget guys.
Right.
And, you're seeing one of the other things I really enjoyed in the book was your discussion of the practical problems of disclosure. And, in fact, it inspired me to go look at some of the surveys. And if you look at the surveys of what people in North America think about all of this, what you realize is the problem with disclosure is not that the man in the street will be shocked or upset.
Right,
it's
right.
The guys who are making money on the secrets are going to go wild.
Absolutely. I'm glad that you brought this up. I mean, look, one of the main reasons is, in one word, petroleum. Whatever these objects that we call UFOs are using for their source of power, it's probably not petroleum.
It's not diesel.
No, I mean, it's something a little niftier than that. Now, whether that
yeah.
means it's nuclear fusion, like controlled nuclear fusion, or something more exotic like the so-called zero-point energy, or I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, it's demonstrably better than what we're using. And so that would presumably knock petroleum right out as the main energy source of our civilization. And if that happens, well, holy smokes. That may be great in the long run for humanity, sure. In the short term, we have to assume that there's going to be a tremendous amount of financial problems. All the people have got their money in petroleum, and there's just it's all over our economy.
Right.
What happens? What happens to that?
Right,
well,
and it's not just petroleum, it's the reserve currency, because remember, the reserve currency is very much organized, the dollar is reserve currency, is very much organized around control of that asset class. And I've said many times I believe the reason that they're the same group is trying to get control of the seed supply and the food supply is that's going to be the replacement. Because you can't, if you look at all the sort of developments on the energy side, you can't imagine that oil is going to be able to play the same role in 2050 that it does today in terms of
right.
the reserve currency.
No, true. The only thing that I'm thinking in terms of oil is that the revelation of some kind of secrecy on UFOs might threaten to displace oil very dramatically and suddenly.
Right.
Rather
and electronic. You point out electronics, steel.
Yeah.
It's many, many. I mean, the creative destruction could be profound for those.
Absolutely. I mean, what if they have a better version of our steel? There goes the steel
right.
industry. I mean, other industries might spring up, but maybe they're not as easy to monetize. I live in Rochester where we have Eastman Kodak, and try as Kodak did, they couldn't really overcome digital cameras and the effect that did on their real moneymaker, which was film. You know, if you were living anywhere in the world, if you took a picture for about 100 years, it was probably made in my city here in Rochester, and suddenly, boom, that's gone. There may be similar things that happen in this brave new world of post, disclosure. If there's technological secrets that come out, there'll be opportunities, but there'll be a lot of disruption. And it just seems to me that the people at the top of the human pyramid don't have a lot of incentive for wanting that secret to come out.
Now, we have a whole pile of questions for you, and what I'd love to do is get a 30-second soundbite to to a whole bunch of questions. Could I do that?
I'll do my best, yes.
Okay. What does Mr. Dolan think about the stories of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Hangar 18 and Area 51?
Well, there certainly is a place called Area 51, and south of it is a place called S4, where there are rumors that there are ET technology has been stored there. Some journalists have found, I mean, there's a lot of smoke there, and I think there's fire. I guess that's a short answer. Wright-Patterson is an enormous, physically enormous space with major underground facilities and lots of stories of alien bodies being stored there.
And you talk about both of them in your book.
There's a lot of them, yeah. So short answer is I think that they're significant, and there's trying to get inside is another story. But, yeah, there's a lot going on there.
Another is what you think of the work of, let me see if I can pronounce this right, Jacques Vallée.
Jacques Vallée.
And interdimensional theories.
Jacques Vallée wrote the foreword to the first volume of my history, actually. Having said that, I think his work is very interesting. Vallée is certainly one of the most intelligent of the UFO writers I think have ever appeared. Very creative. That doesn't mean I think he's always right. Vallée has never been comfortable with the extraterrestrial hypothesis. He's always said it seems just far too mundane to explain the craziness and bizarreness of the UFO phenomenon. I think he's right in the sense that there's something more than simply the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I think he's mistaken if he still believes that the ETH has no part to play in this.
Then a question about the news conference with Sir Fred Doyle, who is a British astrophysicist and astronomer, and whether you were aware of it and what you thought of it.
I think this is the one that was earlier in 2010, if I'm not mistaken.
This is May 10th, 1971. Notice British astrophysicist Sir Fred Hoyle called a news conference and made the following startling announcement. Human beings are simply pawns in a great game. Alien minds come from another universe, one with five dimensions. Their laws of chemistry and physics are completely different.
That one slipped right by my radar. I think he's referring to Fred Hoyle, who was a very famous astronomer. I'll have to look that one up, and I'll have to get back to you.
I'll send you a copy of what he posted.
Wow. Yeah, that's a heck of a statement. I would like to track that one down.
Then another one, why was there so much popular coverage of crop circles a few years back? What is now happening with crop circle research?
Crop circles are one of the most fascinating things in this world, in my opinion. I'm absolutely...
They're so beautiful. I just think they're amazing.
The thing is, well, they're still going on. Anyone can do a web search and just type in crop circles 2010, and you'll be overwhelmed with incredible formations. The thing is, these things are often 3 to 5 to 600 feet in diameter of incredible complexity. They appear overnight, sometimes in the middle of the day. No one sees them being made. Who's doing this? You've got either a bunch of secret team of Leonardo da Vinci's running around the fields, and not just England. They come there in Ohio, in the United States, and they appear to be, incidentally, related to the mound culture of ancient America. At least this is the analysis of one researcher that I spoke to. Bottom line is I think there's definitely something going on. I do not believe, not for an instant, that these are all the creations of human hoaxers. Yes, there are human artists who do this. I know of a number of them. And by the way, they don't always do this just for getting their kicks by fooling people. They consider themselves artists. Okay, fine. But the fact is that the ones of true complexity and, I mean, absolute mathematical mastery, these are not being made by these artists. What's up with that? I don't know. It's one thing that leaves me with some optimism. If this is an ET thing, then I've got to feel that there's something positive about that intelligence, because it's some of the most beautiful things in the world.
Sure, ET graffiti.
Yeah. That's right. Would that our own human graffiti be so beautiful?
I know. You know, where I grew up, we had some pretty amazing graffiti.
That's true.
Well, Richard, before we end, I just want you to give out your website and tell us again when your new book is going to be available.
Gladly. My website is keyholepublishing.com, just like looking through a keyhole, keyholepublishing.com. I have a new book coming out called AD, After Disclosure. I've written it, co-authored it with a gentleman named Bryce Zabel, who was the creator of the television show Dark Skies back in the late 90s, and Bryce has done a lot of other work for television. It's our what-if book. Think of it that way. What if UFO secrecy were to end? And what we really do try is to, with a feet-on-the-ground approach, to envision how that might change our world. After, with that completion of that book, I'll go back to writing volume 3 of my history.
And you'll come on the Solari Report again, you promise.
Anytime. Are you kidding me? I love being on the show.
Okay,
that's no joke. I love it.
Thank you so much. We just, I really encourage everyone to get Richard's books. They're wonderful. It's a great way to get your arms around this whole area, which is really so important to everything. It's really important to managing our assets and time and sort of being a citizen of our world. And so I really encourage you. It's a great way to approach this topic and sort of understand and explore all aspects. So, Richard, again, thank you for joining us on the Solari Report.
It was my pleasure, Catherine. Thank you.
Okay, in closing, coming up next week, the Precious Metals Market Report. We'll be publishing our article on Glass-Steagall, the Volcker Rule, and the new financial reform. Franklin and I are also going to be doing a little special on the dangers of dependency on government money, exploring that a little bit more. And the following week, Dr. Robert Lustig on sugar addiction, a very accomplished doctor and a very important topic. So sugar addiction, how do we get it and how do we get rid of it? That will be right after the hearings for the Department of Labor and Treasury on the retirement option, so I'll be reporting on that as well. One announcement, I did an interview as I was driving out to Montana. It was published in Germany called Behind the Wheel. I posted it up on the blog. It really rocketed. It was very much about the drug and money laundering and the connection to the black budget. And interestingly enough, we suddenly got a new wonderful group of subscribers from Europe and the Middle East. So welcome. We're glad to have you aboard. As I said in the article, if we're going to leave the current central banking warfare model, we need a new model, and the only way to get that model is to invent it and emerge it, and it's going to be a global conversation. So we're delighted to have you aboard. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. Thank you for joining us. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.